For all of our listeners out there, you have until April 6, 2012 to enter the Webcomic Beacon Spring 2012 giveaway. That's right, we have 4 copies of the Family Bones graphic novel 2-volume sets ready to be given away for people that go to webcastbeacon.com/giveaway. Find out ways that you can enter to win this, and one winner will, in addition to the graphic novel 2-volume set, will also get the Boobles' first album, which is, well, the Boobles are a memory parody of Beatles songs, basically, and you can get their first album if you are the top winner of this year's Spring 2012 giveaway. For more information, go to webcastbeacon.com/giveaway to find out how you can enter, and you only have until April 6th, 2012.
You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
Because you've been on the show once before.
Yep. Probably a little over a year ago. Talk about some of my other webcomic stuff.
Mostly the 30 characters challenge.
Yeah, that's right.
Were you the one who started that?
I am, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I tried to keep up with that a couple of months ago, but I was working full time and I made it to like 10.
Yeah.
It's daunting. I was able to do it the first 2 years, but last year, I it was a half-hearted effort on my part. It had grown so big that by the time I, you know, got everything all up and running and organized so that it could run smoothly, I ended up just kind of emptying the tank on that. So I created a few but did not hit.
Yeah. Well, I remember some of my friends heard about it like back when I was still in school, and they were like trying to build portfolio stuff, and they ended up they turned it into like a 100 character challenge, and they just tried. It was like, I think the rules they put on it was like it had to be 100 new characters, and they each had to be like for a different story. So it's kind of like when you wrote the backstory for them, it was like a little disconnected, like, you know, slice of a totally new story.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, man, there was some cool stuff. But...
yeah, you know, the stories that have come out of it have been pretty great. I mean, there have been people that have, creators that have sort of linked up with each other based on it. You know, one guy did 30 head models, like working in a 3D program.
I saw that one.
Yeah, and he had, it came up as a... on a job interview for him, and
nice.
And you know, being able to see him knock out 30 of these things in 30 days sealed the deal for him, and he's gone on to sort of land his dream job with a 3D animation studio, and he's done a lot of cool stuff, like stuff that people have seen. So yeah, you know, just hearing that that it had an impact like that just, you know, obviously makes my day.
And this is episode 224 of the Webcomic Beacon here at webcomicbeacon.com, part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com, promoting and covering the creativity and creative process since 2007. I'm Fess of ArgerComic.com, and with me, we have Kelly Turnbull back once again from the punchlineismachismo.com, or manly guys doing manly things. Welcome back.
Hello.
And this week, our focus on communities, webcomic communities, or comic communities, we should say, from comicstribe.com, comics with an X, Tyler James. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we had you back like over a year ago on an EP, an ill-fated sort of side podcast thing that didn't really go much anywhere, talking about your 30 characters challenge that you were talking about just right before the show, and so everyone who is listening got a bit of that as well. So Tyler, should I just call you Tyler, or is...
sure, yeah, Tyler, Ty, whatever. it all works.
Awesome. So, and we'll go ahead and link to that episode once we get this show posted. We are also broadcasting this live on Vocal. You can go to webcastbeacon.com/live and listen to when we have the Webcomic Beacon shows broadcasting live. most Sundays, it seems. So, first off, Tyler, how you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Good Sunday weather. I'm glad to see the weather's back to getting lovely. There's like this beautiful time of when the weather starts to turn and look really nice, and then my allergy season kicks in. So I'm sort of in that nice zone right now, but I will be miserable once I start the allergies kick in for a little bit. But I'm enjoying the beginning of spring at least.
I know exactly how you feel. I didn't used to have allergies, and I started getting. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was just driving along, and then suddenly. That's shit. And I'm just like, I had to pull over. It was so bad. It's like, what the hell is happening?
One of those things like you're not allergic to something for a long time, but then your body decides it's going to start making like antibodies against it. And like, then you just turn allergic immediately.
Yeah. Eventually winter became the only season I wasn't allergic to. But I found if you get like the allergy eye drops, those help a lot. Even if you just take like say Zyrtec or something like that. Because it gets into your whole system there. So eye drops and Zyrtec really, really helps.
Yeah, you got to come up with that's kind of what I've had. I mean, I ended up trying a bunch of stuff, and you know, some of it just feels like sugar pills, whereas other stuff will knock you out completely and make you worthless. So
yeah,
kind of figuring out the right thing, you know, it's very, very it's a process, but. Anyway, I will trade that for, even though it was a relatively painless winter and snow-free winter for us anyway here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, this was a pretty crazy winter. Oh, hey, I'm going to be out in Massachusetts in a week, I think.
Oh, yeah? Nice.
Yeah, I'm going to ConBust.
ConBust?
Yeah, it's one of the college ones.
Oh, okay. Yep. Well, I'll be down for the Boston Comic Con, which is coming up swiftly. Boston's good. It's good. Speaking of allergies, I never had them as a kid, but, as I got older, they started kicking in, and it turned out, like, I lived in New Orleans, Washington, D.C., and then Boston, and it turns out, like, those three cities are, like, three of the top five in terms of like pollen count and allergen count, like the worst cities. So I think that's part of what kicked them in for me. But happy to see spring starting up again, because that also does mean the start of convention season, and that's always fun.
Yep. And I got one at the end of this month too. It's I don't have a table, but last year there were open tables. People didn't show up, so I'm just going to bring all my stuff anyway and say, if nobody shows up there, I will buy that table. So hopefully that'll work. But I do have a few panels on it, and that's what I've mostly been doing at conventions is doing some panels. But this is all about Comics Tribe at comicstribe.com. Comics with an X. Creators helping creators make better comics. So, tell us about what Comics Tribe is, like what started it.
Well, you know, I think I sort of at the heart of it, I'm an educator. You know, that's sort of my background's in education, and about three and a half years ago, I started writing a column for the Good Guys over at. Comic related, just sort of about my experience as a small press creator, independent comic creator, artist, writer, and then, you know, eventually publisher. And I kind of wanted, I really enjoyed, you know, writing these articles and as they sort of crystallized things in my mind, like, you know, what's my writing process? What are the tips and tricks that I'm learning? And I kind of wanted to take it a step further. And so, Comics Tribe was the goal of it was always sort of two facets is one for that it to be an online resource for creators to sort of network and help each other improve on craft. And so I partnered up with Stephen Forbes, who's an editor and writer, and he sort of came up with a couple of really great resources and column ideas for that he was going to run, and then I write a weekly column over there
myself, just sort of about my process, and then we've just sort of built. We started there and built from there. So the idea was always to have a website that's going to be a go-to resource for people interested in creating comics, and then there was also the idea of building it as an imprint that we could, you know, publish under as well. And it got to the point where, you know, I'm working in co-creating series with other people. And so, you know, Tyler James Comics as my website and personal brand wasn't going to or wasn't big enough to hold the things that I was going to be doing and working collaboratively. So I've sort of built Comics Tribe as a place for myself to publish under and Steven to publish under. But just as the site itself has attracted creators and things, we've sort of slowly been growing and expanding our publishing portfolio of series to include works from other super talented creators that have been interacting with us through the website. So, you know, right now we've got about six or seven titles out in development, or either in development or out on the shelves, and we're building from that building from there right now.
Very cool.
I just realized this is where that Proven Grounds thing is. I realized when you mentioned Steve Forbes. Yeah, the writer that I worked with, like I was on Mythology. I was just an artist, but the writer that I was paired up with submitted a few scripts here, and it was one of those like very tough but fair situations where it was like, you know, she's very new to like writing for comics, and so it was like stuff she needed to hear, but you know, it was definitely tough love.
Oh yeah, I mean, Steven is brutal, and you know, I give so much props to anybody that submits a script to the Proving Grounds, because you know it's tough. And he's sort of and I think to his credit, he's sort of toned down his
delivery.
He's getting a little softer in his old age, and a little more teachery, and not as full on brutal as I know he can be. But you know,
this is like college level advice.
He could.
I would not. I'd be too ashamed to share the first script that I got note back from Steven. You know, I would be too embarrassed to do that, because you know you could see like it was bleeding in red, and you could almost you know see him pounding out the frustration. But at a certain point, you know, getting critical feedback from someone who's immersed in the craft of that you're trying to get into, and who's not your mom, and who doesn't give a damn about your feelings, your ego, or your, and is just looking at the work and what's on the page. Until you're ready for that, you know, that face, like you're going to be limited at what you can produce, I think. And so, yeah, the Proving Grounds is because I don't think there's anything else like it on the internet. You know, there are places, there are writer forums out there where you can post scripts, but inevitably the feedback is cool or meh or something very light and superficial in terms of feedback. And what Steven actually does is he treats it as if it was a script that he was hired to edit, and he will go line by line and point out what's good and what's bad and what's, you know, god awful and should be completely removed off the face of the earth. And so I think for people that are ready for that kind of feedback, it can be a game changer as far as their personal development as far as the craft comes. So, you know, if you are a writer and you've never had that kind of critical feedback on your work, I'd at least take a look at the Proving Ground. And I also often find that, you can learn a lot by seeing the feedback on other people's scripts. You know, we get so, you know, we treat our intellectual property and our ideas and like they're our babies, and we get so wrapped up in them we can't see, you know,
right,
what's great about them and what is seriously flawed. But sometimes if you can see the flaws in other people's work, you can apply that to your own.
Well, yeah, like every one of these, like I've just clicked back through a couple pages seeing if I can like find people I know in it. But yeah, every one of these like sort of has a different theme. Like, you know, it's like, oh, if you're writing a well-known superhero, if you're pacing for a graphic novel, if you're pacing dialogue, yeah, it's like giving info organically through dialogue. Like it's all, you know, teaching by example, I guess. Like, you know, it looks like if you're in a college class for, you know, like art, because I, you know, I took screenwriting classes and I took storyboarding classes and stuff, and it looks like, you know, the same kind of like analytical, I don't know, critique you'd get on that in front of your classmates, that, you know, you learn just as much from hearing like other people's stuff get torn apart as from your own stuff get torn apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's really what the whole idea. And I think the appeal of that, that column is, we also have a column that doesn't update nearly as regularly, but it's sort of the same thing for sequential art. Game of Thrones artist Tommy Patterson has a column on the site called Draw Over, and basically he does just that. He gets user-submitted, comic strip reader-submitted sequential pages, usually about four or five, and he will sort of talk through the what's good and what the artist needs to work on, and where it would serve an illustrative purpose. He'll actually go and like draw over their original pages to point out anatomy flaws or pacing things or changes they could make to make the page sing more. So, you know, we try to provide stuff for both writers and artists over at Comics Tribe to sort of cover the, and I tend to focus with the column that I write on sort of the synthesis of the two, and also one, how you sell this stuff and that side of it as well. So those are, we try to cover the breadth of it at Comics Tribe, and you know, we're still very much in sort of phase one of what we want to do with both the site and the community. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, we're actively working on, you know, continuing to push it and add new features and add new things that are really going to make the community grow. But so right now we're still very much in a beta form, but it was sort of one of the things where, well, we could wait until we have it all perfect and the perfect site and the perfect thing like that, or we could just start and start getting content out and start building a brand and start building our names and you know, add as we go. And that's sort of where we're at this point with what's going on at Comics Tribe. So, but I think, you know, the first year we launched in January 1st of 2011. And, you know, the first year was focused primarily on the site, and then, and sort of at New York Comic Con last year was sort of our coming out party as a publishing imprint. And then the first 3 months of, or 2.5 months of 2012 has been seeing us, you know, make a fair number of headlines just on the publishing side for the books that we're putting out. So, we've sort of got those two plates cooking, and it's my job to make sure that, we continue to build both of them up.
Very cool. And, we're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the additional people that are on Comics Tribe. Hey everyone, this is Fess, and I just wanted to point out this week on Animation Aficionados, they finally released the episode where I was on, and we were all talking about Teen Titans, the old Teen Titans cartoon show, and I was defending it, and they were saying how much they hated it and didn't like it, and I loved it. I thought it was awesome. I was also on the show with Benjamin Rodriguez, or aka Bar One, from Peter is the Wolf. That comic, not safe for work comic, but you can go ahead and listen to the Animation Aficionados episode, of which we talk about Teen Titans, and go ahead and give your give that show a listen, and you know, chime in with your comments as well on their website. Go ahead, check it out at animationaficionados.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed
We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
And we're back. We're talking with Tyler James from comicstribe.com. And we talked a little bit about the informational, educational portions of Comics Tribe, like Draw Over and Proving Grounds. You're starting to branch out as a brand. So what are some titles underneath the Comics Tribe brand for publishing?
In 2012, we kicked off the year releasing a book called Scam by writer and artist Joe Mulvey. And Scam is sort of Ocean's 11 meets the X-Men. A bunch of superpowered con men are involved in the sort of to get revenge on a former teammate that that double-crossed them, and sort of they're off to Vegas to take him down and on the biggest heist of their lives. And it's a fun new series. Joe's a tremendous talent and a great guy, and he's someone that we sort of got to know just through online, and when he was looking to get his first title out there. He decided to join up with Comics Tribe and get it out there. And we had we've sort of started working directly with a number of retailers to get the word out about Scam and to get retailers to carry the book. And so rather than do the traditional go to direct market thing and put the book in previews and distribute through Diamond and all that, we decided instead to partner up with a smaller number of retailers and do a small print run. For Scam, the first print run was just 777 copies. Mm-hmm. So sort of tying into the Vegas branding of it. We sought to get it into 21 retailers, so the 21 and 777, and we were able to hit all those numbers, and we ended up selling out that full 777 print run several weeks before the date the book was scheduled to go live. And so that was exciting. And just by doing that and getting the word out with press releases and submitting review copies and everything, Scam got a lot of buzz. And, IGN made it their book of the week. I think the week before it was their book of the week was something by DC, and the week after it was another, big name title. So having it by a major website just sort of get lumped in with the big boys was very exciting for us and Joe.
Awesome.
And the books sold incredibly well. There was a Maximum Comics sold about 100 copies within the first week, couple days of sale. I think the first weekend of sale, the thing really flew off the racks at that shop. Those first runs are, have sold for well over cover price on eBay. So it's just kind of exciting to see how an indie book could get that much traction that quickly, and especially for a debut title. So, but again, a lot of this started with me reaching out to some local retailers, and in particular, there's a group called the New England Comic Retailers Alliance, which is a network of roughly 31 shops in New England. So starting by working with them and then expanding, we were able to sign up. At this point, Comics Tribe is in over 50 retailers now that are carrying our books. We're excited about it.
So when you say like retailers, like what type of places are they?
Comic shops.
just like your basically mom and pop or local comic shops?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or comic shop chains in some cases. You know, Maximum Comics has two shops. Okay. New England Comics, I believe, has seven or eight.
Okay.
Graham Cracker Comics has about eight in the Illinois area. So you know.
Did you just call these places up and say, "Hey, we're a limited, you know, small publisher, blah blah blah. Would you want to work with us?" Is that basically what you did, or was it a little bit more involved?
Well, you know, we there's a lot of hustle put into this, and a lot of legwork, and you know, everything from emails, calls, to walking into shops. What helps is I had a few local retailers that got on board early. You know, Larry's Wonderful World of Comics is who was also an organizer of that New England Comics Retailers Alliance. You know, we sort of started this micro movement and started doing this approach last November with a book that I wrote called The Red Ten, and got it in about five comic shops, most of them local, and that's sort of what it started. But the sort of thing is, if you can get one comic shop, you can probably get five. If you can get five, you can probably get 10. If you can get 10, you can probably get 50, and just so on.
Hmm.
And that's really sort of what we've built on. But I think we also, with Scam, we were able to make some pretty good offers. If stores that got 50 or that ordered 50 or more copies, we were willing to do a store branded variant cover for them. And we had and stores that that ordered 100, we did the variant, plus we threw in some artist edition sketch covers that Joe did. So we did tailor some really good incentives, but also, you know, part of there still is this collector mentality, this, you know, exclusive gotta have it mentality, that and a value add that having books that people want or would be or might be interested in and that no one else has is still a powerful selling point for retailers.
So, I was going to say, speaking of variant covers, what I've heard people complain about series that run too many variant covers. Like, where do you think is the, like, you know, the good? I mean, if you're doing store specific variants, then that's, you know, not so big a deal because you're not going to have like 20 variants in every store. But like, you know, where do you think it stops being an incentive for people to buy more comics, and where it starts being confusing to the buyers who see what looks like 20 different comics and it turns out to be one title with a bunch of variant covers?
Right. Well, I think indies and the big two are sort of playing on different levels, you know. And the variant stuff that that goes on with the major publishers, you know, so I see a lot of that. I see the objection where it creates confusion, where it creates other things. On the flip side, I think creating cool products is always a good idea for whether you're a publisher or whether you're or if you're a fan of the medium. And so, things like store branded variants. I mean, those are things that retailers love because, hey, you know, they've gone and built something here, and now they have they have a marketing product as that markets their shop as well as a saleable product. And whereas I think, you know, for some Marvel promotions, you need to order 2,000 copies of a book, and no comic shop sells 2,000 copies. But, you know, you order 2,000 and you can get a Spider-Man variant. You know, our 50 offer was just too much to refute. You know, it was too good to pass up for a lot of the retailers that we signed on. So that was something that we could sort of use to our advantage. The other thing is the sketch cover variants. You know, there's a big, big collector market out there still, and a market that of for people that love original sketches, one-of-a-kind items, and comics. And sort of the sketch covers sort of combine the two. So it's sort of a no-brainer to do things like that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, from a publisher standpoint, especially indie publisher standpoint, I'm always going to look to create something that's rare, unique, hot value add, premium version of the books that I do, simply because there's next to no money in floppies. You know,
yeah,
the margin is so small on floppies that you need to have something that has a better margin if you're going to keep doing this. So, so sketch covers for the Red 10 number 2, which just released. I did a I'm calling it the blood smear variant, where I sort of hand blood smear on just 50 signed copies. Each, you know, the original quote unquote blood, using show blood or what have you. But it looks cool and it's unique. It's sort of a unique item, and they're limited to 100. So if the series does blow up or continues to build traction, it's going to be a rare thing. I see some of the skepticism, you know, as a fan as well as a reader, and I've never been a variant junkie. But there are those readers out there, and as long as the cover's awesome and it's something that they want, you know, it's a tool in the publisher's, toolkit, is sort of how I see it.
Yeah, I know, like, I very rarely buy, like, single issues and stuff. Like, I usually wait for trade paperbacks. I'm not so stringent about that if it's kind of an indie thing, because I don't know if it's going to get a trade paperback. But definitely if there's, like, some original art from the artist or something, some art that's hard to get, I'd be, like, way more likely to buy that than, you know, like, wait for a collection or something.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it's something that I think, you know, there's a, if you have a good market case to do it, it's something worth exploring. And you know, as a small publisher and as just getting into it, you know, we're still sort of learning what works and what's, and we're going to have some flops and some things that, you know, nobody's interested in taking advantage of, but I think it's a big trial and error process as well. But so far so good, I think.
It's like they say, you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes.
Oh, yeah. And if you're just playing it safe all the time, you know, you're going to continue to get what you've always got. And so I think that's just a different something to mind.
So tell us about some of these comics. The Red 10, what is it about?
Yeah, the Red 10 is a 10-issue superhero miniseries. It's a superhero retelling of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. It's sort of how I would kill the Justice League if DC was crazy enough to let me. Thankfully, for most comic fans, they're not crazy enough to let me. But so the Red 10 is sort of it tells the story of Red, the world's greatest detective, who in the opening four pages is sort of brutally murdered by what they assume to be her nemesis, the Oxymoron. And so her former sidekick and her super team, a corporate funded super team that she was a part of, band together to track her nemesis down to his island lair. And things quickly go, and the mission quickly goes to hell. And one by one, each of those characters is sort of plucked off. And it becomes clear that it may be one of them and not her nemesis that is behind it all.
Interesting.
So that's sort of the high level concept, but it's in some ways it's my way to poke a little fun at the big two and the mainstream comics industry. It's sort of, at first, it came out of the frustration with the, hey, we need to raise sales, let's kill a character, thing seemed to happen, you know, all the time. And I was, you know, I kind of was joking, like, why not just make a company policy to kill a beloved character in every single issue? And of course, that ended up getting me thinking, well, how would I do that if I was actually being serious about that? And, you know, the Agatha Christie framework just is something that I think for comic fans, for collector mentality, the structure is just brilliant for the serial storytelling nature. You know, you talk about the desire to or the tendency to wait for trades on things. And that's in a lot of ways, you know, that's reflective of my buying habits. I usually buy the first issue, and then if it's something that I really like, then I'll wait for the trade. But really what I'm trying to do with the Red 10 is to find incentives to buy it, in multiple ways, you know, the print version, has a thing in the back. There's a double page spread in the end of each, print version. That's sort of the killer's evidence spread. And, but each issue, it only has 1/9 of it. So at the end of each, so as you get each issue, you can sort of open up a double page spread full of evidence that sort of lays out some backstory to the character that dies in that issue. And also sort of talks and also gives clues as to how the killer took them out and knew to take them out. But you can sort of piece each of these double page spreads together with the books in each issue. And it sort of adds to the, so it's sort of like you're putting together a puzzle. But again, you know, just another kind of cool thing that I hadn't really seen done before that adds something to the print version.
It's kind of like when you buy those Avengers action figures and they each come with like a little piece of a giant Galactus toy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, just comic fans in general really dig the crap out of, you know, it taps into that collector's mentality. And that's another great thing. I think why mysteries work so well with comics. It's, you know, I haven't read most of the reviews I read are like, well, I'm pretty sure I know who did it, but I'm going to enjoy seeing how all these characters die in each issue, things like that.
Well, that's it. Sometimes it's not about like, you know, how, like, you know how something's going to end up, but it's not about, you know, it's not about seeing the good guy win or seeing the bad guy lose or seeing the person, you know, get like found out. It's, you know, it's about seeing how that happens. Like it's the journey, not the, you know, the destination.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, in most cases, you know how just about everything all the media you consume is going to be. You know James Bond is going to win. You know Spider-Man's going to save the day. What's fun is figuring out how it's executed and what you learn along the way. So, but yeah, the series is it's written by myself and drawn by Cesar Feliciano, who I met at a comic convention a couple years ago, and we sort of stayed on each other's radar. And when his schedule freed up, I reached out to him, and we got this thing going. And you know, now it's in more than 50 comic stores, and we also sell it digitally. And yeah, we're excited about how that's going. And for the digital audience, we've added about 20 pages of bonus material to each issue. Stuff like, you know, script samples. Actually, I put an excerpt from The Proving Grounds where 6 pages from The Red 10 were reviewed by Steven, and I included that in the digital version, along with layouts and additional bonus sketches and pinups and things like that. So, you know, for the different ways we're getting it out there, we're trying to find different ways to add value to the products.
Very cool. Let's see here. We're going to take our last break. When we come back, we'll wrap the show up and talk a little bit more.
Some lust for gold and silver, and some for gems and jewels, but some want greater treasures, and they use their software tools. For some of us quest for knowledge, and we want it undefiled. But now and then, you get a troll who thinks he's Oscar Wilde. Beware the wiki pirates! who sail the server seas. They flaunt their fake credentials and their advanced degrees. They control the information with bullying moderation, 'cause arrogance and online swagger trump your expertise. No matter what your sources, no matter whom you cite, he doesn't want to hear it, 'cause he knows for sure he's right. There is no compromising, no bargain or accord. He's never heard of you, or doesn't like you, or he's bored. Beware the wiki pirates, they love to wield their clout. All day they'll argue details that no one cares about. They don't see as overreaching their demands for page deletion. Web pages are in short supply.
And what if we run out?
Yo ho, yo ho, no one ever thought. Yo ho, yo ho, in this web we'd be caught. The wiki's meant to document the stuff the mainstream missed. Instead, we've got a pompous sot who's building up his wrist. So if you've got a subject that really interests you, beware the wiki pirates, they've got nothing else to do. Someday we'll have a knowledge base with all you want and need. Till then we'll take cold comfort that they're likely not to breed. Beware the wiki pirates who whine at our attacks. They're only trying to help us, never mind the rules and facts. They're just honest, not unpleasant. It's not their fault that we're peasants. If we'd only see their brilliance, everybody could relax. Beware the wiki pirates, that basement-dwelling band. They regulate and obfuscate what they don't understand. The grief they give you will reduce you to trivia and minutia, and praying that you really do get banned. Only public notoriety will get you in their library. Be grateful they're all lost at sea. They try to delete the land.
That was Wiki Pirates by Tom Smith, found at musicalley.com by Mevio. I wanted to say, I was trying to look on the Comics Tribe site to look at like properties underneath, and I can't find a section where I'd find the Comics Tribe properties, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, honestly, that's one of the things that is on the must-do soon list, okay. Is that the site is more set up as the creator resource right now,
okay,
than doing both. The various sites, the various comics have their own sites. The red10.comicstribe.com, okay, has all you need for the Red 10, and whatsthescam.net is a great site with scam stuff on it, and some of the other Comics Tribe properties as well sort of all have their own domains. But
so aside from scam and the Red 10, what are some other comics that are underneath the belt?
Yeah, so we've got a great book that's got a lot of acclaim called The Standard by a guy named John Lees, who's a talented Scottish writer, and he and so this book came out last year and got a lot of buzz over in John's native Scotland. It was nominated for a couple awards in sort of some Scottish comics awards over there, but it has yet to get our direct market push to retailers and such. So we're sort of in the planning stages right now as the series being continued to work on how we're going to get this out to the American audience and to our new retail partners and give it the push it deserves. 'Cause it's a really strong book. It's sort of a book about a legacy character and a character who, right, and a former superhero turned chemistry professor who his sidekick, who ended up replacing him, is murdered, and he sort of comes out of retirement to find out who killed his former sidekick. Mm. A lot more than that. But it's another superhero book that is done by John Lees and then Jonathan Rector, who's a guy that I think is, you know, not one or two projects away from
being sort of a big name in mainstream comics because he's a super talented dude. So we've got that going. I've got a couple other series that I do. The Tears of the Dragon is sort of a swords and sorcery fantasy that I do, and I do that as a web comic. It's currently on hiatus, but it's also under the Comics Tribe banner. And then we have Epic, which is another sort of superhero action comedy that I do with Matt Zolman, and that's something that we've been working on for a long time and hope to get out later this year as well. So we got and in addition to that, it's still a little cool and surprising to me, but I guess understandable considering some of the decent coverage that we've gotten based on the books that have gotten out to market, like Scam and the Red Ten.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a fair number of creators come to me with properties and wondering whether or not Comics Tribe might be interested in publishing them.
Yeah, I was. Mm. That's one of my questions. I was going to ask, how do you go court people, or can people apply, etc.?
Yeah, and we didn't have a submissions policy or anything up on our website. And I one of my recent articles over at Comics Tribe was sort of explaining my stance on that. And right now we're still very much a shoestring operation. We've got myself as publisher and Stephen Forbes as editor in chief. We've got a digital comics manager in Yannick Morin, who sort of handles all the coordination that's required to get our books in with all our various digital distributors, and we've got a PR person in Lisa Marie Wilson, who's been tremendous at getting the word out and coordinating our reviews and just getting press releases out and written and just beating the drum about our stuff. But our bandwidth to get books out and to work on titles is still pretty limited. So, we're not actively looking at properties, but if we see something that is sort of fitting into the model that we're building, and something that we think that our retail partners can sell, and we can find good touchstones and for them and good selling points that it would make a direct market push,
mm-hmm.
We're open to those conversations. And
so don't call us; we'll call you.
Well, I've had plenty of emails recently with people just kind of floating things, and honestly, one of the great things about Comics Tribe is that it's connecting things with people. There's I just announced in an iFanboy interview the other day that we're doing an oxymoron anthology, and the oxymoron is sort of a character that was in the Red Ten, who's sort of a Joker analog. He's the nemesis of the character that's killed in the beginning, and he's sort of the one who's might be being framed for her murder. But the character, just from visual design standpoint, and just the idea of a psychotic killer obsessed with contradiction is one that I think was worth exploring. And, the fact that I was anytime I had had a sketch cover with the oxymoron on it, it sold in like 15 seconds at New York Comic Con, just made me realize, hey, I got to do more with this character. So I sort of reached out to a handful of writers that are sort of up and coming, or in some cases already just absolutely killing it in comics right now. And the guys that I know and said, hey, want to write a Joker short for me, but use the oxymoron instead, and sort of set a framework. And so I collected about 9 stories written by some great talent of up and coming writers, but also some people that I've met through Comics Tribe that are guys that have submitted work to the Proving Ground, and it keeps getting better and better every time they submit, and people that are putting the work in, And so interacting with me through Comics Tribe is probably the most sure way of getting me to know about your work and think about how, you know, Comics Tribe might work with it. So that's some kind of a cool development that's been going on. And not everything, you know, like you guys, your primary focus is on web comics, and I love, you know, I love the medium of web comics, mm-hmm. and I, you know, make them myself, and I've done stuff myself, and I can recognize that not everything that I've done or not every idea that I have is mainstream direct market comic bookshop marketable, and I think that's okay, and I think the web is a great place. And it's been proven that you can have success stories and alternative business models for mm-hmm. your stuff. But at the same time, in the case where you are making things that could be a hit in the direct market, just ignoring that model is something that, you know, I think might be a detriment to some creators that might otherwise just think, oh, I'll just put it online and go for it. You know, the stuff that we're doing and working with retailers on is sort of what I consider, you know, red meat for the target markets of mainstream comics. And so for products that are like that, we're still, you know, we're excited about getting it out to the place where, you know, the comic readers congregate. So
I was actually going to ask, do you find that there's a similar sort of theme or style that, is kind of unilateral across a lot of the comics that Comics Tribe ends up picking up? Like, do you take much kind of off the beaten path stuff, or is it, you know, a lot of very, like, you know, do you look for certain types of, like, art styles, or, you know, like, a lot of the time if you see, like, Avatar, like a lot of their comics all sort of have a, you know, like that Avatar look to them, or, you know, like DC and Marvel sort of have their house style. Is, you know, if like James Stokoe came to you with Orcstain, like, would you be like, oh yeah, this is like something different and the sort of thing we'd look into? Or would you be like, oh, I don't know if that's really our thing? Or
yeah, you know, it's tough. And I'm sort of in talks with a creator right now that's got something that's in a different genre than what we've published so far, but it's really good. And you know, one of the...
It better be.
And quality, you know, quality trumps just about everything. And makes, you know, any publisher really take notice. And also, you know, I think we're not sort of actively looking for superhero titles, but because we've got, you know, we've got plenty of those right now, and we're actually kind of looking, all right, how do we get into some other genres and things like that? But at the same time, sort of recognize that there's the mainstream audience, the retailers, you know, they need some. It's got to be, you know, close to something, or you have to have an idea of, all right, well, whose fan base am I stealing with this? You know, and it helps if that fan base that you're going after is a sizable one, and is one that, you know, that you can reach out to and you can get a hold to. Hold up.
That's something I've heard a lot, that with, you know, with webcomics especially, everybody says, like, oh, you need to make something very unique, like nothing else. Like, it has to be totally, you know, you can't compare it to anything. But it's like, if you're trying to make a business out of it and sell these things, it's like, you need to be able to, like, go to a publisher and say, like, this is the market that I'm targeting, or, you know, it's similar enough to this that we'll be taking those readers.
Yeah. I mean, you need to know what you're selling, and I think doing a couple conventions is a surefire way to figure out, you know, hey, who the hell am I selling this stuff to? Who is my target audience? Because, you know, one thing I've found from conventions, which is, I think, is a brilliant thing, is that there is a book, like there is a person for every book out there. You know, I've walked through conventions and walked past books and been like, oh my goodness, I would never in a million years pick that up. And then I'll go back to buy my table, and 2 minutes later, somebody's walking by and he's got that book in their hand, you know, and smiling and happy with his purchase. So one of the great things is that there's there is a, you know, there's a market out there for every, just about everything that you do. However, that market could be 20 people.
Right.
You know, at some point you need to have a sort of, you know, come to Jesus moment with yourself and figure out, you know, am I going after a niche of a niche of a niche? And if so, am I going to be satisfied with selling to that entire niche of 10 people?
That's what I found. Like the more specific your niche is, the more appreciative those people will be. Like, you know, you might have 10 fans, but there'll be 10 like diehard fans who would take a bullet for you. Or you might have like, you know, 10,000 fans who like really wouldn't notice if you stopped making the comic, you know. It's sort of like, you know, which audience are you comfortable with?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, just from a creative standpoint, like you're not tied to that audience for the rest of your life. Like, you know, I did a sort of slice of life romantic comedy, I spent about almost 2 years, I think, on it, maybe even more all in. And it was an online graphic novel, and, you know, my numbers never got huge, and book sales of the graphic novel are still, you know, I'm probably still under 100 all told in terms of book sales for it. But, you know, two or three just absolutely outstanding emails from people that said, you know, I found this book at exactly the right time for me. And, you know, here's what was going on in my life and here's how awful it was. And by the, you know, I stood up and cheered when X happened in your story because it was so, you know, reflective. And just getting one of those, you know, in some cases that for the books that you're doing, that can be enough, you know. And if you can prove that you can, you know, have that effect and in one instance, well, you know, you're probably pushing your craft to the point where maybe the next thing you do or the next thing or the next thing or the next thing might have more impact. And so sometimes, you know, like sometimes you just got to create and hope and do the absolute best you can. Even if you don't have, you know, that market developed, but, yeah, it's tough.
Well, and even like sometimes, like, you know, if you are making something popular and you're like up on top of the heap and you've got a huge audience, it's like, you know, you might just decide that it's time to bow. Like, you know, if it's like what happened with Calvin and Hobbes, where it's like, you know, he was getting tired of drawing the character and he was like, you know, he was like, I just want to end this before I run it into the ground or I get sick of it. I lose the heart. And so he just retired from the strip and, it, you know, people still wanted it. And I don't know, I heard he's just kind of like painting watercolors now and burning them at the end of the day. But I don't know how much truth there is to that. But it's like he's definitely doing things that are, you know, not, you know, he's making art, but it's not for a huge audience like that. But it's just that's where he felt like he needed to go with his life. And
yeah, I mean, you know, artists are strange birds sometimes. But yeah, and. But one of the things that I love doing and on Comics Tribe, I think will have his help is even if a creator brought me something that I know has no chance, you know, in Hades of getting much traction in the direct market and that I couldn't, you know, really help with that aspect of it, I love the strategy for it. And there are so many, just tools out there right now from, you know, Kickstarter to Comics Press to digital distribution entities that are out there that, you know, the excuses are gone. And there probably is a model or an approach that could be effective with just about every property. And so part of the challenge is figuring out, okay, well, what's my approach going to be? How am I going to get this thing? How am I going to get this thing with people that need to see it? And so even if Comics Tribe, there's a book that Steven's working on called Runners, which is sort of a, it's basically the zombie apocalypse happens, And in that case, what, you know, what the F do the vampires have to eat now? Mm-hmm. So it's simple, high concept, but very, very much, you know, treading on the grounds of things like The Walking Dead and other things and such. And without the big names attached to it, it's probably going to get lost in the zombie shuffle of your comic market. But if you can put that out on the web for free and collect it and serialize it and really tap into that big audience that's out there, perhaps this book could have build an even bigger audience than it could have gotten trying to first join the crowded zombie space in your local comic shop.
Well, that's it's such an important way to look at sort of oversaturated genres like zombies and stuff, because people are saying like, oh, zombies are dead, RRR, because there's just, you know, so many zombie things out there. But, you know, there's still about the same number of like good, funny, original zombie things. And it's like, even if there's an oversaturated market that like there are so many things in it, if you can make something that's just original and like, you know, something that sort of plays with the genre in a different way, you know, like, takes it, looks at it from a different kind of clever direction, then there's still room for you. Like, if you can get out that, like, it's zombies, but it's different zombies, then, you know, you're still going to, like, get those those people who are always zombie fans.
Yeah.
It's true. Like, there's always a market for good. There's always a market for quality stuff.
And even still, I mean, there's like a lot of people out there that have spectacular art and stories in webcomics, and then you can look at their stats and then you wonder why they're not, you know, you need to make an effort to really put yourself out there. I mean, webcomics is a great example. There's, you know, YX is so much more popular than this. This is fantastic. Well, what are they doing differently? And a lot of times, they're not putting themselves out there a whole lot, or they're not doing the, you know, it's very DIY. You got to get out there, you got to push your comic, basically.
Well, I think part of it, too, is just looking at, like, what kind of an audience you're targeting, because, like, if something has, like, a kind of gag-a-day stickman comic, like, yeah, I think I might have gone into this last time, like, those are basically, like, potato chip art, you know, it's like, you're like, oh, I read another one, and it's like, soon you've clicked through, like, 600 of them, and you didn't even notice it, but if you're reading something, you know, like, Lackadaisy or The Meek, or, like, something that's very, you know, very professionally made, and, like, you know, just something that you need to savor, like a story you need to enjoy. Mm-hmm. That's like sitting down for a steak dinner, and you don't always have time to sit down for a steak dinner. Like,
true.
Yeah.
But if you know, you could have, like, when I do my Crash Course to Webcomics presentation, one of the things I say is you could have the greatest comic in the world, but it means nothing if people don't even know you're there. If they don't know it exists, it doesn't do any good. Unless you get it out there and you try to promote yourself and all this other sort of stuff. Legwork.
Yeah. Yep. And I think creators also just, they need to put in a little bit of effort of figuring out what it is that they're doing that's remarkable. And not remarkable in, you know, in the sense of amazing, but just remarkable in, you know, literally worth talking about.
Yeah, like what you're bringing to the table that nobody else is, that, like, you know, that's unique to you.
Right. And so, you know, with the sort of the beating the drum of things about Scam and the Red 10, you know, the story with Scam when it first came out wasn't that, you know, that, hey, we made this book and it exists, buy it. The story was, you know, here's this upstart, you know, here's this upstart new publisher that's partnering with just 20, you know, 21 retailers, and have sold out, you know, this number of copies, and just saying, you know, and trying something new. And, you know, the story about when the Red 10 was released was, all right, here's those Comics Tribe guys back again, and they've doubled the number of retailers that are carrying their books in 1 month. So that was the story. Mm. And then you bake in, you know, what's awesome about the book, and you bake in things like that with the press release. So, you know, just kind of trying to figuring out what's going to get, you know, what's going to get people that are talking about these, looking about these issues, noticed. You know, very rare are the sites that are just gonna beat your drum for you without tapping into some broader context. You know, so to the extent that you can find out, you know, what the stories of the day are, and talk about how your book is incorporated into it, that's sort of where the PR mindset comes in, and you know, you need to wear a lot of hats to have a successful endeavor at this thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think we're going to be coming up at the end of the show here. I know Kelly has to get going to WonderCon soon.
Yeah, I should probably wake up my boyfriend.
Right. Before we go, is there anything else you want to close out with, Tyler?
One thing I should plug: I'm doing an online workshop with the guys at leanintoart.com on conventioning. So speaking of conventioning, the workshop is called Absolute Consense, and it's 50-plus strategies to 50-plus strategies to double your network, triple your fun, and quadruple your profits at your next comic book convention. And you know, for those of you listening that are interested in just in the creative aspects, and I'm sure that's a big part of your listenership, Lean Into Art is a really cool site to check out. They're the guys behind Jersey Droz and Rob Stenzinger, and Jersey has just been a big time educator and advocate for comics, and basically they sort of do
from the Art Story podcast, or.
Yeah, yep, from Art and Story.
Yeah, I call him Yeja because he told me that's actually his real name, so now I can't get that out of my head. So when people say Jersey, I was like, oh yeah, Yeja.
him. Yeah. They do these online workshops, and they're available for, you know, for both live and then after the fact as just DRM free downloads.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing one with them the last Wednesday of the month. I would check that out. And then my next convention I'll be at is Boston Comic Con in a month. So any New England area people, come out and see me.
Very cool. Excellent. So that brings us to the end of this episode of the Webcomic Beacon here on webcomicbeacon.com. Once again, we had Tyler James from tylerjamescomics.com and Comics Tribe, comics with an X, .com. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, guys.
And we've also had Kelly Turnbull from the Punchline Is Machismo or manlyguys.com.
Thanks for bringing me along.
And I've been Fess of ArdraComic.com. See you next week.